Welcome, everyone. My name is Amy Zuckerman. I'm your moderator, and welcome to session 4107, Who Gets Served? Opening the Door to Discrimination. My name is Amy. Couple words about me. I work on diversity and inclusion and affirmative action issues within a large technology company. And my community work right now is focused on Native American issues. And I'm also the former chair of the City of Boulder Human Relations Commission. So I'll introduce our panelists. To my left is Georgetown constitutional law professor Susan Blanc, attending her first, being part of her first panel. So welcome.
Thank you.
To her left is retired judge Bill Thorne, who spent 34 years with the, let me get this right, the Utah Court of Appeals, as well as he's also a retired tribal judge. To his left is Jamison Green, transgender advocate, and to his left is Ian Millhiser with the Center for American Progress and the author of Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. So let's go ahead and start with Professor Blanc.
Hi. Excuse me. It's great to be here. I was delayed because I have a cold, so pardon me if I clear my throat a few times. We're all familiar with laws that outlaw discrimination. Congress began to adopt such laws in the 1960s, and they've been very successful in integrating our country. We would all be shocked to go into a restaurant and find that the restaurant owner would say, "I'm sorry, I'm not serving you because you're African American or some other racial group that he dislikes." We have pretty well accomplished a ban on that kind of outright discrimination. But where we're, the current crisis that we're facing now is what to do about discrimination against transgender. And so some of you may have heard about the case that I just want to bring to your attention because it's presently before the Supreme Court, and we are expecting the court to issue a decision by the end of June this year. And that involves the situation where two gay guys were going to get married, or getting married, and they wanted a wedding cake. And they went to a baker and said, "Please bake us a cake." And he said, "No." He said, I don't believe in gay marriage, and I have a First Amendment right," he claimed, "to say that I don't believe in gay marriage, and I even have some religious objections to that, and so that's also protected by the First Amendment. And so, no, I'm sorry, I will not bake you a cake for your wedding." Well, they found that quite disturbing, not surprisingly, and the state of Colorado found that disturbing, and they said, "Mr. Baker, you are violating our laws against discrimination. You cannot refuse to bake a cake for this couple." Well, the baker said, "Nonsense. I have this First Amendment right to decide for whom I'm baking a cake." And so that set the stage for this constitutional, I wouldn't call it a crisis. We have one of those going in Washington now, but more about that tomorrow. But it has set up a very strong constitutional question where the baker is presumably legitimately upset that he might have to bake a cake for some group that he disapproves of. And he, as I say, is claiming a First Amendment right to not have to do this. The gay couple is saying, "Well, no, you can't discriminate against us, and we want this cake." So that is what the issue is before the court. But it's a larger issue too. It's because if you claim a First Amendment right to discriminate against gays, you can claim a First Amendment right to discriminate against Muslims. You can claim a First Amendment right to discriminate against African Americans. You can claim a First Amendment. So what's happening now is the religious right is using the First Amendment to, I don't know, but I'd say tear down our anti-discrimination laws, or at least create a huge hole in them. And it's important to remember that this baker is not being asked to bake a special cake. The gay couple has not said to him, you have to put a gay couple on top of the wedding cake. The gay couple is not saying you have to do a rainbow thing. They're asking for a wedding cake. And so we should all be very concerned when people are trying to use the First Amendment to drive a wedge into our anti-discrimination laws. I think the court will be very worried about this First Amendment wedge. On the other hand, they also will be sympathetic to people's First Amendment right to their beliefs. The Obama administration never had an opportunity to weigh in on this particular case before the court. The Trump administration has weighed in, and they've weighed in on the side of the baker who wants to refuse, who is refusing to make the cake. If I had to predict, and I guess that's partly why I'm here, that's where I get paid the big bucks, I do think the court will side with the gay couple. But I think they'll have a hard, they'll be troubled, they'll write a narrow opinion, but I would like to believe that at the end of the day, they will reject the Trump administration position and reject the baker's position and side with the gay couple. But don't mistake this. This is the beginning of an effort to drive a wedge into all anti-discrimination laws. This is not just about a gay couple. It is not just about a wedding cake. It is potentially much larger than that.
Thank you very much. Judge.
I hope the professor's right. I'm not nearly as sanguine about the Supreme Court's ability to do the right thing. I'm a Pomo Coast Miwok Indian from Northern California. So I remember there was a time within my parents' lifetime that there were bounties paid for Indians to be killed, and children were sold in Northern California. There were newspaper articles about it. So to me, that lack of equality is very real. But I also have to say I'm troubled because as a lawyer, I got to pick and choose who I worked for. I got to say no to people. I can remember one time somebody selected me, obviously because I was a tribal attorney at that point. I had a ponytail to my waist. And they thought it would be good to have an Indian lawyer represent them as they went in to challenge a tribe. And I said, no, I don't believe in what you're doing. I am not going to represent you on that. I'm philosophically in favor of the other side. And I would not want somebody to tell me I did not get that option of saying no to that. So I'm troubled. I mean, I want the baker to lose. But in other professions, that's a little bit more of a slippery slope. Tribal traditions taught me to be a judge differently than a lot of my state court colleagues. I had just been a judge for a short while, and this 70-year-old man came and took me aside, and he was a tribal judge. And I know he didn't graduate from high school, and I'm not sure if he graduated from eighth grade. But he was a judge because he was patient, he was fair, he was kind, and he listened. Not a bad job description in my mind as for a judge. But he told me that the first responsibility I had was not to sit in judgment of people. And I'm thinking, that's not what they taught me at Stanford Law School. And he went on to say, instead, your first job is to treat everybody with respect. Everybody who walks through that courtroom door deserves respect. And then he gave me a test to apply to myself. He said, when you're on the bench, imagine everybody in the audience is your cousin, your niece, your nephew, your aunt, your uncle, your brother-in-law? And could I go home at night and explain to my grandmother how I treated those people? Not did I give them what they wanted, but did I treat them in a way that she would approve of? So for me, the constitutional issue, I recognize, but I think a more fundamental issue that we need in this country is we need to learn to treat people with respect. And judging that by how you would want your family members treated. Even the ones that you don't want to claim all the time. So I'm going to stop there.
Thank you. Jameson Green.
Thank you. Well, you mentioned transgender, Professor. That seems to be my area of specialization. So I'll talk a bit about that. And who is being served? So I'm going away from the cake, and I'm going to talk about access to health care, for example. Just as an example, there are many other areas like employment and housing, but access to health care is extremely egregious. Transgender people, in spite of laws prohibiting discrimination, are told routinely that they are not going to be served in the emergency room. They are not going to be served in the physician's office, regardless of what they're there for, simply because they're transgender, and it makes other people uncomfortable to be around them. So that's, you know, we get right back to it. That is the cake issue. It makes the baker uncomfortable to be around gay people. So that is essentially where we are stuck. And I go back to John Stuart Mill, actually, and I think about, you know, where do your rights end? And it's essentially, and where do my rights end? My rights end at the tip of your nose. Your rights end at the tip of mine. And we have to respect each other apart from that. You can't hit me. I can't hit you. We have to respect each other and work out the differences. We have to come to a compromise. We have to recognize that transgender people, in fact, are human beings. When you're told that you are not entitled to health care, that you may not receive treatment for your laceration on your leg or your broken arm, you basically are less than human. And that is an extremely painful experience. Well, I think I'm going to tell a little story about an incident that I experienced. Some of you may have already heard this, but I am violently allergic to peanuts, and I accidentally ate a cookie at work one day that had peanuts in it, and I was in very early in my transition, and from female to male. This was 1988, and basically I was taken to the emergency room because I went into anaphylactic shock, and you know, they said, "Welcome, Mr. Green. We're happy to see you. What seems to be the problem?" "Well, anaphylaxis." "Okay, come right over here to this gurney," or wherever I was. And this nurse started putting electrodes on me. I had to take my shirt off. And I was wearing sort of like an ACE bandage thing around my chest to compress my breasts, because that's what female-to-male people do in the beginning of their transition. And until they're eligible to have surgery. And she goes, "What's the rib belt for, Mr. Green?" And I thought to myself, well, I could say ribs, but what if I lose consciousness? What if I need to be catheterized? What if, you know, on and on. So I decided, well, I said, "I'm a preoperative transsexual." And she freezes. I can feel her freezing. I can feel her lack of breathing. Her hand is on my shoulder. She's slightly behind me. And she waits And then she says, does that mean you're going to be a woman? And I said, no, actually quite the opposite. And she's still frozen. She waits. And then she says, well, you're doing very well. I said, I'd be doing a lot better if I could get some epinephrine. And she goes, oh, yes, yes, of course. And she rushed, I'll go get the doctor, and she rushes out of the room. It must have, it took more than half an hour for the doctor to get there. I could have died. And during that time, every janitor in the hospital came and mopped the floor around my bed. When the whole thing was over, and I got the epinephrine, ultimately, as you can see. when the whole thing was over, they never asked me if there was anyone they should call. They never asked me if, you know, I could get a ride home or something. They didn't care. They didn't care at all. And even when I was in the hospital having my final surgery, genital reconstruction, the nurses that were on the day shift wouldn't look at my face. They wouldn't, they barely wanted to touch me. They had to get me up every day and have me walk around the floor. And they were really uncomfortable doing that, but they did it. And the only nurse who really spoke to me like a human being was a guy who was on the night shift. And he had to wake me up in the middle of the night and make me take a pill so I could go back to sleep. But he was the only one who spoke to me like I was a human being. And it was really scary to be in there all alone and, you know, not really sure if you've done the right thing, and there you are, and nobody cares about you. Nobody cares. And it's really, really painful. So who is being served when we discriminate? And who is being served when we end discrimination? Who is being rejected? To what extent is the loser of these cases impacted by the loss? What actual harm comes to them if they lose? And yet, what actual harm comes to the person who's supposedly protected by these non-discrimination laws? For now.
All right. Thank you, Jameson. Ian Milheiser.
All right. Thank you so much. I am the person in the unfortunate position of following Jameson, but I'll do my best to, lay out a few thoughts about the law here. What we are fundamentally talking about, as I think a lot of people have acknowledged, is a tension between between civil rights laws and claims that that someone's faith should trump a civil rights law. Even in the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, where there is a free speech claim, you know, the fundamental moral tension in this case is between the claims of people who are asserting religious liberty and the civil rights law itself. And so what I think I need to point out first about these religious liberty cases is that plaintiffs in these cases are necessarily asking for something that's very unusual in civil rights law. You know, Brown v. Board of Education, the students showed up and said, we want to go to the exact same school as the white kids. It was about equalizing treatment. The Ledbetter decision, if you remember that one, was about a woman who's saying, I deserve to be paid the same way that I would have been paid if I were a man. So, you know, generally, when someone goes to the courts to enforce a civil rights claim, they are claiming they should be treated the same way as other people would be treated. Religious liberty cases are about someone saying, I should be treated better. And you may agree with that. I think that affirmative action is justified in certain circumstances. But we are talking about something that is akin to affirmative action for religious conservatives when we talk about these cases. The idea is that there is a civil rights law that applies universally to everyone. If you open a business, you can't discriminate along certain traits, race, religion, sexual orientation in Colorado. And certain individuals are claiming that law should not apply to us, even though it applies to everyone else. And until very recently, I think the Supreme Court realized that a degree of caution was required when someone comes to court and says that they should be exempted from a law that applies to everyone else. And this is especially true in the business context. So the rule until recently was basically the nose rule. It was my right stop at your nose. Or the way that the court put it in a case called United States v. Lee, when followers of a particular sect enter into commercial activity as a matter of choice, the limits they accept on their own conduct as a matter of conscience and faith are not to be superimposed on the statutory schemes which are binding on others in that activity. There are several reasons for this rule. One is that we have a market economy, and if certain businesses are regulated and certain businesses are exempt from regulations, then the exempted businesses have an unfair advantage in the marketplace, and we don't want that. Another reason, though, and probably the primary reason, is that we live in a pluralistic society where we all have to, you know, balance each other's rights against each other. And I think that the court recognized that we should not allow one group to effectively strip away the rights of another. And so that was how the Supreme Court operated until 2014 in the Hobby Lobby decision. What is unusual about the Hobby Lobby decision, to my knowledge, is the first time that the court ever said that a religious liberty claim can be brought to diminish the rights of a third person who is not a party to the lawsuit. And in Hobby Lobby, the issue was birth control. So it was workers who might want access to a health plan who want birth control versus a company that didn't want to provide it. But everyone was aware that the next case was going to be a discrimination case, including Justice Alito, who wrote the Hobby Lobby opinion. I think that Justice Alito's response here is fairly ominous. He went out of his way to say at the end that laws banning race discrimination would still not be vulnerable to a religious liberty claim, but he was very pointedly silent about other forms of discrimination. So to give you an idea of what this could look like, you know, you're all probably familiar with the Masterpiece Cake Shop case. You're probably less familiar with the case from the 1980s called Fremont Christian. The facts of Fremont Christian was you had a Christian-identifying high school. And if you were a man and you worked there, if you were an unmarried woman, they provide you with health benefits. But if you were a married woman, they did not give you health benefits. And the reason why is because they believed that God wants the husbands to provide for the wives. And therefore, if you were a married woman, you should get your health insurance through your husband's job. And they claimed they had a religious liberty right to be exempt from anti-discrimination law saying that you can't treat women differently than men in the workplace. They lost. Okay, but it is very far from clear that they would lose in this Supreme Court. You know, the same issue is now coming up in the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, which is a case about whether or not someone's religious beliefs can allow them to violate a ban on discrimination against people on the basis of sexual orientation. You know, Judge, I am also sympathetic to, like, the claim that we don't want to have a too broad rule where, for example, lawyers can't pick their own clients. I've tried very hard in my legal career to make sure that I don't have clients that I don't approve of, and it's a nice thing to have. But the law also has an answer to that, which is that generally the way that civil rights laws work is legislators create what are called protected classes. And so you can discriminate on the basis of any reason, pretty much any reason you want. If I have a business and I want to kick you out because I don't like your hairstyle, I'm allowed to do that in nearly every state I'm aware of because there's no law banning discrimination on the basis of hairstyle. There are laws banning discrimination on the basis of race, religion, sexual orientation in some places, gender identity in some places, sex, national origin, And so you can't engage in that kind of discrimination. But I'm at least not aware of a state that says that a lawyer cannot discriminate against clients because they disagree with the viewpoint of a client. So I guess where I will close with this is that ultimately I think what Masterpiece Cake Shop and really a lot of cases that are now making their way to the Roberts Court is about, it's about who we trust. And here's what I mean by that. Typically, the way that civil rights laws have operated is we have trust that legislatures won't pass crazy civil rights laws. So you hear all sorts of crazy hypotheticals. Some of them were brought up in the briefing in the Masterpiece Cake Shop. Well, what if you have a Jewish baker who doesn't want to make a Nazi cake? And the answer to that question is, well, we've always trusted that a legislature isn't going to pass a law saying you can't discriminate against Nazis, because that would be a dumb law. And legislators generally don't want to do that. I think the reason we're seeing this conflict arise is that for religious conservatives, the presence of laws banning discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity are in their mind the equivalent of the law banning discrimination against Nazis. And so they no longer trust the legislature to get to decide who is protected by civil rights law and who is not. And that strikes me as a very frightening outcome, even beyond the implications of this case. Because at the end of the day, at least in the federal system, judges are not elected. And I would much rather have the ability to, if I don't like what my civil rights laws look like, get to decide, get to vote for someone who's going to change them, than I would have Samuel Alito get to decide for me what civil rights laws my state and every other state gets to have. So thank you very much for bearing with my legal lecture there. I guess we'll move on to the next speaker.
Thanks. All right, we're about to turn to our Q&A portion. Before that, I'd like to share a statement from the CWA. Want to mention our 70th crowdfunding campaign to celebrate CWA's 70th year. We've set a goal to raise $70,000, and we're a quarter of the way there. So we'd appreciate your support. Any amount helps. And all you have to do is click the donate button in your app or visit the CWA website. So I'm seeing a lot of young faces in the crowd, and I'm wondering, everyone 21 and younger, would you mind raising your hands? Look around the room. Here's the future, folks.
Wow.
So for questions, we're going to be multi-modality here. I've got the app open, so if you want to use the app, great. We also have super old school 3x5 cards. Remember those? Those of us who are a little bit older in a protected class of 40 and above. And some funky pencils that are from our parents' generation. Super tiny things that maybe came from a bowling alley, you know. Okay, so here's the deal. First question's in, and it says, does discrimination include political persuasions? And I think maybe latch on to that. Is there such a thing as political affiliation discrimination, and are there protections? I'll say from the corporate side in my corporation, political affiliation or perceived political affiliation is protected. So who would like to take that question?
I'll try. Well, it's a matter of individual state law. In general, when the government hires people, there are prohibitions on discriminating on the basis of political persuasion. I'm not too aware of it in the private sector. Is anyone?
Yeah, the only jurisdiction I know of is D.C. has a law that requires that bans like some sort of discrimination on the basis of political affiliation
part of private businesses.
But it's not very robust, because I mean, at least it's what my general counsel has told me when I'm hiring people. Like, you can't tell someone I won't hire you if you're a Republican, but you can say, you know, we are an organization that is in the business of supporting policies that the Republican Party generally doesn't like. And so if you want to come work here, I don't care what's in your heart, but you have to actually advocate for the things that we believe in.
Question was, would that be true for Nazis, someone with a, like a stated affiliation with Nazis?
Again, I'm not aware of any laws either protecting or prohibiting discrimination on the basis of Nazis. Are you?
Yeah, I mean, like, conceivably a Nazi could argue that, like, if they were a member of the Nazi Party, and I guess they were discriminated against because of their membership in the Nazi... You know, conceivably, I think a political affiliation law could touch membership of the Nazi Party. I don't think that it would go to, you know, you could still say to the Nazi, like, you can't bring any of that Nazi stuff to the workplace. I guess, like, your question raises why I think that generally political affiliation discrimination laws are a bad idea and why most states haven't enacted them. And even like in the places where you do see them, they aren't especially robust.
But I do believe the government cannot discriminate right. On the basis of political persuasion. So your question would be more directed to private people, and they can discriminate.
Okay, shifting gears a little bit. Question, can Bill Thorne talk it or describe the anti-discrimination case won by a Native American lawyer against the city of Colorado Springs?
No.
Okay. Next.
I don't know the case. I'm sorry.
All right. Next. How would you help deal with and prevent discrimination? Best ways? Jameson or Bill?
Well, I think education is absolutely critical to sensitizing people to the rights of others, and not in a way that comes from a law school class, but comes from a heart position, which if you can just get in there, then you can go to the law school stuff and talk about those kinds of theories. But I think people need to understand that they are as human as anyone else, and that how would it feel if they were treated this way, you know? So basically it's the golden rule stuff. And just really needs to be hammered in that without violence, hammered in, that people should be considerate of our fellow people.
I know I'm oversimplifying, but I think a lot of discrimination comes from the basis of fear mm-hmm. or distaste. Mm-hmm. And the remedy for both is really familiarity, where you get to know people as a human being. Now, I know perfectly straight human beings that are atrocious human beings. That does not make me afraid of all straight people. It's the individual and their characteristics have little to do with who they are. Who they are is how they treat other people, how they treat the world around them. That, I think, is much more important. So to the extent, for example, if you had a family member who was this baker, how would you deal with that? Well, some family members, you can invite them to dinner when all of your friends are present. Some of your family members may be a lost case, but that doesn't mean that you still can't demonstrate by example that there is a wealth of goodness from all kinds of people.
I'll add what might be a bit too simple of an answer, but you can enforce civil rights laws. They work. Just in case there's any doubt, I'm just pulling this particular stat out because it's one that I happen to have memorized. But in 1965, when the Voting Rights Act was signed into law, 7% of black Mississippians were registered to vote. 2 years later, 60% of black Mississippians were registered to vote. So civil rights laws work. We haven't solved racism, and we haven't solved all the problems we have with discrimination in this country, but you also don't have a book that African Americans used to have to travel with whenever they went to the South that told them, here's the restaurants you can go to and still be served, and here are the hotels you can go to, because they weren't easy to find. You know, we don't live in that world anymore. And the reason we don't live in that world is because we enforce our civil rights laws against people who discriminate.
At least in theory, we do. I mean, when I was appointed as a judge in the state court, 1986, there were two minority judges in the whole state. And we were in the same two-judge courthouse. And we made a point of carrying our judicial ID visible in the car so we did not have to pass the attitude test if we got pulled over.
I'm going to shift gears. There's wonderful questions coming in. Gun laws regarding public carry in classrooms. My right to not have guns present versus staying away from places where people carry. Thoughts? Jameson Green.
It's like a speed limit law. You can't drive, you know, over 25 or 15 or whatever it is miles an hour in a school zone. It's not safe. It's not safe to have guns all over the place. In my opinion, right to carry laws are a threat to society. And we should really think seriously about those. I know there's the Second Amendment. I think we have to think really seriously about what the Second Amendment means in a modern context. I think there's a lot of work to do there.
Yeah, I'll just add that, like, carrying a gun is a choice. It is not always the case that, you can find examples of civil rights laws that protect against some type of discrimination, including religion, where people have some choice in the matter. But generally, civil rights laws protect people either in, with respect to traits that are completely immutable, that you have no control over. You can't wake up one morning and decide that you're going to be a different race, for example. Or they protect people on matters that are considered to be so core, so crucial to our identity that, even though I could wake up tomorrow and decide that I want to be a Buddhist, we are offended by the idea that the government or even state or even private actors would try to force that choice upon me. And like carrying a gun just is not in that category. You could discriminate against people for all kinds of reasons. If I'm going to hire someone, I can decide not to because I don't like their attitude or I don't like the way they dress. And it seems to me that carrying a gun is more akin to that than it is to race, religion, sexual orientation, gender, all these things that are both very much at the core of our being and that are often things that we literally have no power over.
So comment was, what do you see to the NRA members who say it was?
That they're wrong.
Okay. When people apply for citizenship, is there still a question about being associated with or being a member of the Communist Party?
I don't believe there is, and I don't think there should be.
I don't know the answer. I mean, I think there is a question about, like, whether you've ever been a part of an organization that, like, sought to overthrow the government of the United States. But I don't think they still have the Communist Party question on there specifically.
Right. In terms of civil rights laws working, how do you feel about the fact that there is more segregation in schools since Brown v. Board of Education than there was beforehand? What is the problem there?
Well, there's a big difference between state-enforced separation and people choosing with whom they want to associate. And I think that you know, one of the big success stories in this country is Brown v. Board. I have to mention that I clerked for Thurgood Marshall, and he's a hero of mine. So you may detect some bias here. But I think that that decision and the decisions it sort of led to were was enormously successful. And the fact that people today might choose their associations, that is part of our freedom. And I guess I think that that's a good thing.
I think it also points out the problem that if we rely on discrimination laws to solve societal problems, that's just not enough. I mean, the fact that people choose to live in certain places is not always voluntary. It has to do with the historical antecedents of redlining, where people could not get loans if you were of a certain race to buy a home in a certain place. It has to do with the funding in schools. For example, Ferguson. I don't know how many of you are aware, but 2/3 of the students in Ferguson are required to attend a high school that is not accredited. So even if they graduate, they can't get into community college. Missouri has a law that says if your school is not accredited, you can choose to go to any other school you want. But they passed a special law that gave Ferguson School District a special status, so those students can't choose to go somewhere else. And then the school district there was formed because it used to be one large area, and each enclave of basically white suburbs decided we want our own school district. So they're surrounded by lots of little school districts that are well-funded because they're funded by property tax. And then what's left is no money for the people in the inner cities. So discrimination laws may say you have the right to go there, but that doesn't mean you have the opportunity to go there. And so we need to rethink things that have a racial impact or have a discriminatory impact that are not per se discrimination, like that funding formula. If all of the state funded students at the same level, then choosing to go someplace or another wouldn't have necessarily a detrimental impact on those other kids.
Mm-hmm. I agree with everything the judge just said. I'll add that another closely related problem is that the Supreme Court itself has largely abandoned Brown. And it did so in three stages. So in 1973, if you're familiar with Detroit at all, what you will know is that beginning in the 1960s, you saw a massive white flight from the city of Detroit proper into surrounding areas. And this was done, you know, very much with discrimination in mind. It was done because white people living in the city of Detroit didn't want to live amongst black people living in the city of Detroit. And so to counter this effect, the state of Michigan tried to create schools that integrated across the city line so that instead of just having all the black kids in the Detroit schools and all the white kids in the suburban schools, we would have school districts that encompassed both I'm sorry, this wasn't the state of Michigan. This was a court-imposed order because that's relevant in a second. The idea was that the districts would encompass both the people in the suburbs and in the city so that you could still have integrated schools. The Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that, or at least the courts can't order that. And the reason why is because unless you could show that the government intentionally drew the school district lines for the purpose of maintaining race discrimination, Brown didn't apply at all. About two decades later, there's a case called Dowell, which held essentially that if a school district is desegregated for 5 minutes, that it is no longer subject to the original desegregation order that required it to integrate. and that so long as it doesn't take steps that intentionally segregate it, it is free to do whatever it wants. So if it wants to, for example, draw lines in ways that map neighborhoods, and those neighborhoods happen to already be segregated, and so that leads to resegregation, unless you can prove that that was done, like unless you can read those lawmakers' minds.
Or unless you could read their tweets that said it.
Right. Yeah. And then the third case was a case called Parents Involved, which is perhaps the most ridiculous of these decisions, because Parents Involved said that that school districts are not allowed to voluntarily integrate, or at least take certain steps that help to integrate them. So, I mean, there's lots of structural reasons why we have segregation in this country, but one reason is that the Supreme Court's commitment to desegregation really didn't last very long at all. For the first 10 years, there wasn't very much enforcement of Brown v. Board of Education in the Deep South. Part of that is because we didn't have the legal tools. It wasn't until the Civil Rights Act of 1964 made it easier to bring challenges that you could really have systematic enforcement of Brown. So you had, like, real enforcement of Brown from, like, 1965 until 1973 when Milliken v. Bradley was decided, and that's it. Those were the years we were committed to desegregation.
And in all those cases, Thurgood Marshall dissented.
Prisoners. Prisoners are stripped of a lot of their rights even after they have served their time. If prisons are there to reform criminals, shouldn't ex-convicts have all of their rights back when they finish their sentence? Is this a type of discrimination?
Absolutely it is. In Florida, 1.4 million people are not allowed to vote. And guess who most of those 1.4 million people are?
I don't think we have an actual agreement that prison is supposed to reform criminals.
But we should.
Yeah, we should, but we don't. I don't.
Question on the rights of trans individuals. Do the obstacles for reassignment surgery constitute discrimination against trans individuals? Could this be solved through the 14th Amendment right to privacy?
I don't think right to privacy actually would solve access to surgery. I think that the issue is whether the surgery is medically necessary. And that has been under dispute for quite some time. I, as president of the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, I issued a statement about the medical necessity of all of these treatments, whether hormones or surgeries, that was approved by basically all of the doctors who belong to the association. And that statement has been extremely useful for attorneys litigating cases where people were denied certain treatment in certain facilities. Usually, there's a problem right now. I mean, this is a long-standing systemic problem. There are not that many surgeons who are really skilled at doing these surgeries. So they are few and far between. We're doing a lot, as much as we can, and with the cooperation of some now surgical societies that and medical societies that are devoted to surgery, that will actually educate more surgeons. In fact, I think right now there's this training going on co-sponsored by Mount Sinai in New York and NWPATH, World Professional Association for Transgender Health. The systemic restrictions on these treatments has been basically originally out of fear and the idea that it was mayhem to actually do this, that you're creating Frankensteinian kinds of people. It isn't that at all. And it also, people often thought, well, we're going to make people normal now. If they're homosexual, we'll change their sex and then they'll be normal. That isn't what actually happens to individuals who go through these processes. But a lot of the other kinds of discrimination, too, like I wanted to say something about the Schroer case in 2008, which was, it brings back the religious objection idea. An employment case, an individual had been hired by the Library of Congress. They had very high level security clearance. They were really excited about having this job. And they went to lunch with the supervisor before the actual start date. And at that lunch meeting, David Schroer told the supervisor that he was going to come to work as Diane Schroer. He was in the process of transitioning from male to female, and indeed, Diane Schroer was his true identity. And she goes, oh, that's very nice. And then she goes back to the office after the lunch and says, we're going to withdraw that offer of employment. We're going to get somebody else. I'm not going to have anybody like that here. Well, Diane Schroer sued, and she prevailed because the judge said, well, first let me say, historically, under Title VII, transsexual people or transgender people had never prevailed until this case. And the reason, the judicial reasoning was essentially that these are not human beings. That when we say sex, we mean men and women. We don't mean something in between. Or we don't mean something that changed. Or we don't mean, you know, people like you. So in the case of Diane Schroer, the judge said, well, I think we all understand that, for example, discrimination on the basis of religion would include discrimination which occurred because someone changed their religion. And that we would understand that discrimination simply because of the change as discrimination based on religion. So why would we not understand this discrimination as discrimination based on sex? And ruled in favor of Diane Schroer. And after that, the EEOC began taking complaints, basically, of discrimination and guiding people in terms of their legal rights. So it's back to religion again. I think, you know, ultimately what we have is a situation where people want to believe something, and they want to believe it, and they don't want to be told that they're wrong, and they want to be told that they have every right to believe whatever they want to believe. And interestingly enough, under most situations, we do feel that. Oh, I think all of us feel that way. We believe what we believe, and we want to believe it. And what we are not learning is how to negotiate the space between us and make everybody be safe.
So we have about 15 minutes left, and there's such good questions. I don't want to miss what I'm seeing as kind of a group of questions that have come in. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to read all of these together, and I would really like to hear from each of you about these. Okay. Is part of the reason we have so much discrimination because we have a president that condones discrimination and lets people discriminate against LGBTQI and agrees with people like in the Baker case? How can teens help to stop discrimination and help make a change? How can young people ensure a better future against discrimination? Do you think that discrimination can be solved, or is it simply human nature? And then finally, what inspired you to come and speak here? Who wants to start?
Okay. I think, as has already been said but is worth repeating, what we need to do, all of us, to try and fight discrimination is to be open-minded and to be, as was said previously, discrimination is based on fear and the unknown. And I think one of the reasons that the gay rights movement has been, I think, very successful and rather quick, I'm sure there are gay people who would disagree with me on the speed, but when we think about the women's rights movement, how it started really in the 1850s, and it wasn't until the 1918 that women got the right to vote, that was pretty slow. We think about race, really slow. The gay rights movement moved fairly quickly. And I think the reason was all of a sudden people realized, oh my God, I didn't know that my cousin Joe was gay. Wow. And the fear factor was somewhat removed because we began to realize, oh, I've actually known gay people and they're fine. They are real people. And so I think what we need to do is to educate people. And I do believe that the current administration is hurting that effort. I mean, it's inspiring all our worst instincts. And I think that's very troubling, and we have to work doubly hard to educate people away from that. Just wanted to make sure I think trying to answer all the questions in one quick answer. I think we are all tribal. And that's has its good points. It gives us some security. But it's obviously a bad thing when it makes us treat others as the other and the enemy or the unknown or the scary or whatever. And so education is what we really ought to be focusing on, and recognizing our tribal nature, but recognizing how dangerous it is and how we have to fight it. So I think education is key.
And why are you here?
I am here because I love educating. I'm a law professor, and I love teaching all this stuff, and I like sharing it. And I think the current environment in Washington, which is where I come from and where I teach at Georgetown, is a dangerous environment, and it's promoting all the worst in our human nature. And so I'm here to breathe the fresh air and find that it's not all as bad as it is in Washington. So I'm here to learn as well as to try and share what I've learned over the years.
Thank you so much, Judge.
And I obviously have no objection to being tribal, since I'm Pomo and Coast Miwok, and my tribe is from 60 miles north of San Francisco, right on the coast.
I didn't mean to speak badly about tribal.
I understand that. It's just... It's those
I'm tribal too.
It's those little cues you hear sometimes in the back of your mind, and you have to trust people's good intentions. I actually don't believe that this administration is making things worse. It's making things worse for people's lives. But part of that is because it's peeled back the facade that we had solved the racial problem. There are a number of my friends who 10 years ago did not believe that racism was still a problem. Now they're beginning to have second thoughts about it because they see it around them. So I don't think it necessarily made it worse. It's just it's not hidden anymore. And that makes us all uncomfortable. And that's good and bad. I mean, it's bad because that's the world my grandkids are going to grow up in. It's good because if we don't acknowledge it, we can't change it. Why am I here? Mainly because I love to hear and learn about things that I don't know, hear different points of view. That's why I used to use my law clerks. I didn't have them write memos and polish them. Instead, they would do their work and they'd come in and we'd talk about it and we'd argue about it. And that would help crystallize my thinking. Sometimes they changed my mind. Always they improved my analysis, my thought process. And that's what I love about being here is I hear different points of view. I hear people I disagree with, but I have to rethink, why do I disagree with that? What's the process? And I learn new things. That's why I'm here.
Thank you. Jameson?
I have to agree with everything that's been said so far. I'll probably agree with you as well, Ian. Now I've lost track of the questions.
What can young people do? And are we in an environment where...
Okay.
Yeah.
Young people can be present and be aware of the privileges that they have and the privileges of other people versus them, and consider how these things balance and work to create an environment that invites civil discourse, that basically allows people to feel safe wherever they are to be able to express themselves, whoever they are. And even if it's not something you agree with, as long as you're not punching them in the nose and they're not punching you in the nose, it should be okay. You need to have this respect for each other. So I think you should do everything you can to notice when respect is diminished and try to elevate it again. Seek out things that will eradicate different ignorance. Try to, when you realize you don't know something, try to find out something. Try to find out more than one thing. Try to find out cross-referenced things. Make sure that you don't get everything that you know from the internet. Talk to people. What else?
Why are you here?
I'm here because, actually, for much of the same reason as the judge here, who I think is really an amazing person. I think everyone's amazing persons. I came here to meet all the amazing people, including all of you. And I've never heard of this conference before. I was totally surprised. Call came to me from out of the blue, and it was Betsy Hand told me all about this, and I was, well, yeah, of course I want to come. I love to talk about different ideas and hear what other people think about different things. It's just really exciting. So I want to thank everyone for the opportunity that allowed me to be here. Thank you.
And Jameson, if I could add a little bit to that, is there something about this topic in particular that makes you want to be here?
Well, I went, and part of my process in fighting for trans rights was to go and get a PhD in law, in equalities law in England, so I could do international law comparisons, so I could look at the difference between civil rights and human rights, so that I could look at the history of legal history of trans people becoming human beings. And dealing with discrimination is something that I began doing right from the start as soon as I became aware that there was a problem. When you're in isolation and you realize that you need to go through a process like this, and then your doctors don't tell you, oh, you're not going to be able to access your health care, because, what? So, I realized there were a lot of problems and that trans people weren't speaking up because they didn't know how. And I was a writer. I was not afraid to speak in public. I knew that I could bring my skills to bear in service of the rest of the community, and so I tried to figure out how to do that. And fighting discrimination is a big step. It's a big first step. Getting laws in place don't solve the problem, as has been said. But what they do is provide an avenue to explore the problem more deeply and to model the behavior that you want people to have. So I think that's very important.
Great. Thank you, Jameson. Ian.
So I'll agree with the judge that Trump is the symptom. He's not the disease. Mm-hmm. We didn't get here because, like, oops, now Donald Trump's in the White House. We got here because, well, not everyone who voted for Trump was motivated by racism. Everyone who voted for Trump was willing to tolerate having someone in the White House who is motivated by racism. And, you know, to the point about, you know, people who thought that racism was over, one of those people is the Chief Justice of the United States. You know, if you read the Shelby County decision, which was handed down in 2013, the logic of that decision is, well, you know, we used to be really racist. And since we used to be really racist, we needed to have this special, really exotic law that would come in and stop all these people who were racist from being racist in the voting rights context. But now we aren't racist like that anymore. And since we aren't like racist like that anymore, we don't need this special law. I'm being sarcastic, but I am not exaggerating. That is actually what he said in an opinion for the Supreme Court of the United States. And in the very next presidential election, Donald Trump won. So I think every white person has had the experience of being called a racist at a time when they thought it was unjustified. It's happened to me. It doesn't feel good. And I think that the pain of that experience has led many white people, including the Chief Justice of the United States, to want to look away from the issue of race entirely and pretend that it's no longer lingering out there needing a resolution. And so I think we have to confront hard truths. And you can acknowledge progress while still confronting hard truths. I mean, I think we live in a better world now than the world that existed in 1950. But we have not solved the problem. Why am I here? Because this shit pisses me off.
Language. Language. I think that was a period after that, and you'll have to stay after Ian, and we'll have a discussion. Folks, thank you so much for joining. We're at the end of our time. Round of our applause for our panelists. And also, round of applause for all of you. Thank you so much for coming and sharing the time with us today.